Today on Life and Faith.
We don't always know how to say it. It's inside of you and you're looking for the words, and you know, I can't play a piano very well, but then somebody else will sit down and it might be a wordless piece of music, but the tune, the chords, or could be the lyrics, they say it for us. And when that happens, when you have that moment where somebody else understands you, and you feel not alone anymore, you know that somebody else gets it.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. The Irish rock band U2 toured Australia recently, and these tours are always huge affairs in enormous stadiums full of adoring fans, and let's be honest, these fans are starting to look a little bit tired these days. But the shows have always been an incredible experience, and I think that remains the case today. The first time I saw U2 was in 1989, and a few friends and I had bought cheap, limited viewing tickets. Weren't sure what we were going to get, but here was the thing. My brother knew the head of security at the Sydney Entertainment Centre. He said, "Meet me at door one at 8 o'clock." So we went down there and some huge security guards signed our tickets and we were ushered in right in front of the stage. And it was incredible. I was a boy from the country. I'd never seen anything like this. It blew me away. And I've seen them probably about 6 times since then. This band has been touring and writing and recording for about 40 years now, and they've had success all over the world. Their work is the subject of academic study. Not only the music and the poetry, but the art and fashion and set designs. There's a whole industry surrounding the band. And there's even a U2 conference that has been held in different countries that brings together fans, scholars, students, critics, artists, and authors. The aim of the conference is to explore a critical appreciation of the music and the work and influence of U2 and U2 fandom. Now, one part of this study that's especially interesting to us is the spirituality of U2. Scott Calhoun is the creator of the U2 conference. He's a literature professor in the US, and he was in town for the conference and the tour. These two things go together, of course. And he came into CPX for a chat. Now, it's important to note, you don't have to be a fan of U2 to enjoy this conversation. It's about more than just this band and their music. Scott Calhoun, thanks so much for coming. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Simon. It's nice to be here.
Now, you are a professor of literature and an avid U2 fan and an academic sort of in this area. In what way do those two things go together? Do they?
They do. They do for me, at least. And it turns out a lot of other people agree. So we've been having good luck with our conferences. I like to look at U2 as artists, and they've created a text, you know, poetry and a visual text and a theater, you know, kind of moment for people. So yeah. For me as an academic, to analyze what U2 is doing is very similar to what I would do if I'm studying Shakespeare.
Yeah. So it's a happy mix.
Yeah, it fits together very well for me.
Tell me about the first time you cottoned onto U2 and what that was like. Lots of people who are fans will be able to say this sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, I was like a lot of people, you know, I got the cassette tape in the 80s of the Joshua Tree. It was my sister, actually. She had the tape. So I started listening to the Joshua Tree. And I was headed off to college, and in my first year in college then is when Achtung Baby came out. So that was a really, you know, moment for me to be kind of out there on my own and then have that new music come in. So it didn't take long, and I was just down the hole forever. Yeah.
What is it about this sort of thing? Because these periods of your life too, where music particularly seems to capture something of what was going on there for you, and everyone has that sort of story. What is it about music that does
that? Yeah, I've heard that, you know, the band that you fall in love with when you're a teenager or in college, that will be the band you love forever. So that moment, you know, U2's always had a message of searching, you know, for a community and a kind of a place and an identity. You know, that's a theme that goes through their music. So it was just that time of my life. I wasn't especially feeling lost, but Yeah, like that song, you know, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. But that was a good moment in my life to kind of come into touch with artists who are also expressing some of those questions of, you know, who am I going to be when I grow up and what kind of person do I want to become?
Yeah, so in these formative times of your life, sometimes the artists are the ones who are expressing things that you might feel but have difficulty articulating or not even have a place to articulate.
Yeah, yeah, they did. And, the Achtung Baby album was in 91. And that's, you know, a lot of people feel like that's a very dark album. And I wasn't feeling too dark. But what I liked about that was they danced around between the shadows, you know, the light and the dark, and kind of that middle, that gray zone, right? Mm. So... And I'm just drawn to ambiguity. I like mysteries. I like puzzles, and I don't like easy answers.
Yeah.
As an academic, you know, I like to ask questions more than find answers. So,
as a literature scholar, that's a pretty much important part of the job description, I think.
Right.
And it certainly applies to this band. I mean, not and lots of artists actually, doesn't it? Where there's a mysterious or a mystery to it at some level. It's hard to pin down. And there's something important about that.
Right. Yeah, it's the ambiguity that draws a lot of us in because it gives you a space where you can explore and nobody's going to tell you to, you know, you got to land on a decision anytime soon.
Now, this band, U2, that you've spent some time studying over the years, they've endured, haven't they? Most bands don't, of course. What is it about U2 that's meant they've been able to last this long?
You know, there's a great friendship. There's always been a solid friendship in the band, and I think that's served them very well. They care a lot about each other, and then they really approach their work as a craft. You know, when they become successful, it encourages them to just go back to work and keep inventing, being creative. So I think they're pretty hungry still. They are artists who don't feel, I think, like they've finished creating. And they have a great supporting, you know, friendship, and the families are all friends too. So those two things, you know, have served them very well.
Now, do they speak to multiple generations, or is it just old people like me at the concerts? I have managed to successfully indoctrinate my kids into this music.
Well done. That's a legacy. Yeah, you're passing on.
I think so too.
Yeah, the age. Well, I think you'll see in the concerts that the age is pretty. It's getting up there. Most of the fans, but
fans are looking a bit tired.
Yeah, a little. But they still stand for the whole show. They just feel it more the next day. But the heart of the message and the themes and the songs, I think every person's going to hit their life as they grow up, and they're going to realize that that's a band that makes a lot of sense to me, you know. And it usually happens sometime when you're in your 20s, you know. So everybody will get that opportunity, I think, to enjoy a U2 song.
I think so too. Now, U2, of course, draw on deeply theological themes in their music, sometimes overtly Christian themes. How have they managed to make that an acceptable thing in the mainstream? And what is it about them that can have modern crowds singing from the Psalms or like a gospel choir singing Amazing Grace, this sort of thing? I've experienced this in concerts.
Yeah, they have a keen, I think, sense for powerful messages wherever they find them. As it happens, the most powerful messages are in the world's sacred texts, you know, and specifically in the Christian scriptures. But I think Bono's always been drawn to a simple, clear message of hope, and also likes to sing about desires and longings. And so the theological content that supports those feelings works well into a song. And, you know, I have to say that I think their longevity has a lot more to do with the artistry than the messaging, because a lot of artists, a lot of bands, a lot of poets speak some pretty theologically rich material, but the song's pretty boring. You don't want to show up and stand around and listen to it for a whole concert. So they committed themselves to making great art and picking the powerful messages.
I wonder if U2 are able to capture some of the best tradition of being artists who, at least for some of the band, happen to be Christian believers rather than Christian artists. Now, in your field of literature, there are many writers who fit a similar description. They might be a great novelist who happens to have a faith. Is it a bit like that for them, do you think?
They've always, I think, tried to make art that would reach out to a large audience, a wide audience. And they've respected, I think, the dignity of each person's mind and heart. And they rather invite people and rather than sort of, you know, preach at them or beat them over the head with a message. So that's really the message, I think, of a very compassionate, you know, sort of gospel message, is that I'd like to invite you to listen rather than yell at you.
Right.
And as artists, they've been very careful to not kind of, you know, it would be tempting, I think, to, you know, kind of take the easy way and just give it to you straight, you know, and direct. Yeah. But they, again, they like to do it with some invitation and ambiguity.
Now, you've had this U2 conference going now for a while. You've had it in the US, did it in England, it in Australia recently.
Right.
What's the thinking behind that, and how did that come about?
A lot of our conference attendees are curious about the larger messages and also the commercial and critical success of the band. And they know there's something there to analyze and study, and they want to have conversations about it. You know, some fans are just happy to kind of get an autograph and go home and, you know, kind of claim a prize in that way. But the types of fans who come to our conferences want to have a coffee and a conversation for an hour or longer about the things that they really care about that the band touches on.
And what sorts of areas are those
that they
touch on?
They like conference? To, well, we encourage a lot of analysis of lyrics. We think through, you know, the artistry and the poetry of what Bono's written, but then how the music itself and the song craft supports that. We look at everything sort of with a critical eye as to was this a good decision for them at the time. We do some, you know, kind of post analysis of tours, you know, and, you know, the tours come and go and they have different flavors every single time, and as do the albums. So, you know, we kind of look back at the albums and say, well, this producer really served them well. You know, what's different about a Steve Lillywhite album versus a Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois album? And so, yeah, we'll just dig into anything U2 gives us. We're happy to pick it apart.
Yeah, and some of this is quite academic, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So, you know, most of us are coming from a disciplinary training, you know, in maybe sociology or literature or theology. So we try to take a methodical approach to it and support it with some evidence and research, and rather than, you know, every fan's got their opinion, but we try to come up with some reasonable support structures for our theses and conclusions.
Yeah, and all of them are people who, for somehow or other, this music has meant something for them personally, presumably.
Yeah, no, everybody's a fan first, I think, you know, and then the academics come later. Mm-hmm. I haven't bumped into anybody who's sort of a dispassionate, you know, academic about U2.
You do get people who are a bit cynical about U2, though, don't you? There's almost a fashion now, I think, in certain circles to, you know, make fun of them or, you know,
yeah,
Bono's, they, you know, Bono gives us kind of charity
fresh
stuff.
He is a fresh target of, you know, every year he does something to get everybody kind of worked up about. I think he enjoys being provocative, you know, as an artist, and so we enjoy giving it back to him, you know, and the whole band too. So, yeah, there's a criticism, I thought a healthy criticism of U2 that we try to encourage at the conferences. We don't want people to show up and just say, you know, they're the best. We want them to admit there's flaws. There's some failures and there's some mistakes, and there's a lot of disagreement about, you know, maybe the politics that Bono preaches, you know, compared to what the music itself actually says.
Yeah, what about that part of the band? Because, you know, some bands, successful bands, almost the stereotype is they just make hay with the music and the fans and the drugs and the whatever else and the lifestyle. But this band has tried to do something useful with their fame and their celebrity and their success. What's been the shape of that generally?
The paradox probably about U2 is that they've become so successful by being rather boring and conservative with their lifestyle.
Yes.
And with their, you know, with most of their social advocacy, they champion the causes that just about everybody you know, wants to get behind, you know, healthcare and, you know, AIDS relief and poverty, you know. And so they have chosen topics that can do a lot of good to a lot of other people groups, not just their own fans. Not it's not just for their own bottom line, you know, financially. So they do give a lot of effort and time and energy and messaging to great causes.
This is Life and Faith, and we're talking to literature scholar and creator of the U2 conference, Scott Calhoun. Now, in the second part of the interview, we will dwell on some of the music. We would have loved to have played some songs, but frankly, we can't afford it. So you'll have to go with us as we read some of the key lyrics. Now, U2 have been going for over 40 years, but continue to be influential and draw huge crowds around the world. I wondered about the way that growing up in Dublin, especially during the Troubles in Ireland, might have influenced this band even as they became global superstars. Here's Scott again.
A lot of very violent culture, violent history in Ireland that they grew up in and came out of. And I think they've seen, you know, unfortunately, you know, too close what violence does. It doesn't solve anything. It doesn't unite. So they'll always, I think, keep that at the forefront, that there's a nonviolent, there's a loving, there's a peaceful way, and it might involve compromise. And usually that's how healthy communities stay together, is there's give and take, and nobody gets to go home and claim that they've won anything, or they're the only winner in the room. Yeah, that's been very important to them.
Now, you said that they've kind of been boring and conservative, and they've picked up on causes that most people would be happy to follow or support. Have they been a bit politically predictable in that way?
That's a great question. Predictable. I think Bono surprises the band once in a while. The rest of the band members, he's not as predictable as you might think. But it usually comes down to, you can see over the 40-year career that human rights issues, the dignity of the individual, the freedom to choose and control and sort of be in charge of your own life, for better or for worse, but giving the human being freedom is the through line in all their messaging.
Yes, and one unpredictable connection was his friendship, if I don't know if you'd call it that, but a connection, maybe a friendship, with George W. Bush, which had some incredible results through that, right?
Yeah, again, I think that goes back to that sort of young experience of seeing how trying to stay in opposition to other people just doesn't reach usually a very happy, helpful thing, for a larger community. So Bono's willing to cross over and shake a hand and work with people that they are, that is a surprise, looking back on it, that probably wasn't so predictable. But on the other hand, the goal was very predictable. The government, the aid that, George Bush approved and released, and that's, nobody's embarrassed or ashamed about, the results of that.
And that was largely fighting AIDS in Africa,
yes,
right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There seems to me that there's a universal longing in the music of U2, both in the sound and the lyrics. And that's true of blues and gospel music, isn't it? Are these influences in the U2 kind of catalog?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm glad you touched on that, because Bono's always had a fondness for the Psalms, and he always talks about the psalmists, especially David as a blues man. He thinks the Psalms are a great book of blues poetry, and these kind of made lamentations sort of sexy, Bono has, by the songs, of longing and desire and some sadness and some grief, they've turned into pop music that a lot of people enjoy getting up and dancing to, but the message can be actually quite...
Well, that's very gospel music.
It's gospel music. It's a way to work out your own pain and then arrive at some kind of hopeful resolution.
Some of the U2 songs could be considered a prayer. You could think of something like Yahweh.
Take this soul, stranded in some skin and bones. Take this soul and make it sing. Yahweh, Yahweh, always pain before a child is born. Yahweh, Yahweh, still I'm waiting for the dawn.
Take this soul and take this heart, make it break, these sorts of things. They are sounding a bit like the Psalms.
They do. Yeah, they do. And, you know, the songs, Grace.
Yes.
I think most people think of one as, you know, when you really listen to the lyrics, it's a breakup song, but it's all kind of wrapped in a big hopeful hug that it'll be okay. We'll work through it and we'll stay together, even though we're different. We'll find some way to keep the community together and keep our love together.
Well, did I ask too much? More than a lot. You gave me nothing, now it's all I got. We're one, but we're not the same. See, we hurt each other, then we do it again. You say love is a temple, love is a higher law. Love is a temple, love is a higher law. You ask me to enter, but then you make me crawl, and I can't keep holding on to what you've got, because all you've got is hurt. One love, one blood, one life. You've got to do what you should. One life, with each other, sisters and my brothers. One life, but we're not the same. We get to carry each other, carry each other.
Some of this music might sound a bit innocent in our current deeply cynical age. Do you think that's true?
You two enjoyed a decade of irony and really playing around with a more cynical spirit, you know, in the 90s. But that was all a show, a smoke screen.
It's sort of an act, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was
definitely. Theater. You know, but it's also, I mean, a very sincere way for them to acknowledge the fact that the human heart is skeptical. You know, everybody gets hurt eventually, and you lose your innocence, and then you don't run to things with the same energy that you used to because you're afraid. You want to be protective. So I think they understand that. It's not something that they always like to sing about. I think on balance, if you look at the whole songbook, there's a lot more joy and uplift, you know, kind of songs. But they know that it would be dishonest. I think Bono's, you know, said it this way. You know, it would just be a lie to never have a song that just says, I'm really mad at you and you hurt me a lot. And I really don't want to spend any more time with you.
Right.
Yeah.
They've certainly done better than that. You think of songs like Walk On, which says things like, you're packing a suitcase for a place none of us has been, a place that has to be believed to be seen. They're urging people towards the transcendent, aren't they? I mean, music has that effect, but they seem quite deliberate about it.
Yeah, they do. They don't like to keep things too earthy for too long, so they're reaching higher. You know, there's a lot of that kind of elevation and even better than the real thing where, you know, the striving is to get to a higher place, to get to a more maybe divine place, or at least to lift yourself up out of these blues, you know. Take me somewhere higher than the moment that I'm in.
Are you someone who thinks music can have that effect in a sense, even beyond just we went to the concert, it was awesome, but then went back to my crappy life after that? Can music do anything more than that?
Yeah, music's powerful. It's probably in all of us more than we realize. Just think, you know, the songs will come back to you. You'll be humming them. You'll be thinking about them. So there is something, I think, special about that art form that it touches something very human and spiritual in everybody. And I don't know, there's a great power that music has that maybe even watching opera or reading a novel, you know, there's some portability of music, you know, not that you're carrying it around physically, but it's inside of you. And the short songs are a little bit easier sometimes to remember, but it's the tunes, it's the words, they all come back to us.
It's like smell has such a powerful thing, right?
Music. Yeah. It's a very sensual experience.
Yeah. It's not just joy, though, is it? As you mentioned, it's sometimes sadness. That seems really important.
Yeah.
And there's this biblical tradition of lament in you mentioned the Psalms, and even protest against God, calling out to God to fix things.
Yeah.
I think there's a bit of that in you too, isn't there?
Yeah. I'm thinking of, you know, Wake Up Dead Man, the final track on Pop album.
Jesus, help me. I'm alone in this world, and a f***ed up world it is too. Tell me, tell me the story, the one about eternity and the way it's all going to be. Wake up, dead man. Wake up, dead man.
Yeah, Bono's saying, I'm so sick of it. You know, I can't handle this anymore. And yeah, there's a fighting spirit in the whole band, but I think Bono's careful to make sure the lyrics represent that there's a righteous anger, sometimes just maybe a human anger, but it's okay to be angry. It's okay to be upset, and it's okay to ask and sometimes demand, you know, a better world. And then what they use, the challenge they give you after you're done with the song is they ask you to participate in making it better, not just going off and shouting about it, but do something afterwards.
Songs like, you know, anthemic songs like I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, this sort of evokes the human sort of spirit, doesn't it?
This
sort of restlessness,
right,
that we all experience.
You broke the bonds and you loosened chains, carried the cross of my shame. You know I believe it, but I still haven't found what I'm looking for. But I still haven't found what I'm looking for.
In the foreword to Scott's book, U2 and the Religious Impulse, Take Me Higher, David O. Taylor writes this. He says, like the entire oeuvre of U2, I still haven't found what I'm looking for bears the mark of Christ-like hospitality, where sinner and saint find themselves at home with both sincere faith and persistent doubt. I asked Scott how songs like this relate to a life of faith.
Yeah, faith. Bono has this line of, you know, having a certain amount of vision over visibility and believing in what you can't see. And faith is a great way to kind of express the fact that you're not content with everything at the moment. You might have some regret. You might feel like you messed it up yesterday or somebody, you know, somebody hurt you, you know, but then that strengthens, you know, that resolve usually most of us to press on, to continue on. And I think, you know, sort of faith is that energy that pushes us forward to make it better and to find a better place.
I remember watching the documentary Springsteen and I, which is it's just repeated clips of people filming themselves saying what Bruce Springsteen means to them. And there was one where this guy's driving in his car and he starts to film it, but he couldn't do it because he just kept crying. He couldn't stop crying. And what is it about this sort of thing that gets to people so powerfully, do you think?
Yeah. We don't always know how to say it. It's inside of you and you're looking for the words, and, you know, I can't play a piano very well, but then somebody else will sit down and it might be a wordless piece of music, but the tune, the chords, or it could be the lyrics, they say it for us. And when that happens, when you have that moment where somebody else understands you, you know, Springsteen's never met me, but he's speaking on my behalf, you know, and I can hear that in his work. I can hear it in so many other artists. But that moment of connection, and you feel not alone anymore. You know that somebody else gets it. They understand.
Yeah, I remember someone saying the guitar solo in Jungle Land changed their life.
Yeah.
I love stuff
I believe
like
it.
That.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes it comes down to just one lick, one riff. Just that kind of opening, you know, that organ progression at the beginning of Streets, where Streets Have No Name, changes your life.
Yeah.
You're a lifelong fan after that moment.
Can you truly understand the music of U2 without some appreciation of the biblical picture and the biblical themes and those sorts of things?
That's a really good question. I would look at it differently. You know, I think everybody understands when the music's working for them. You know, everybody understands what it means to be heard and listened to. And like we were just saying, and I'm a little careful to say that, you know, I have a better understanding of you because I know something different about
right.
you too. You know, I think what's working for you at the moment is enough, is fine. It might be enough forever. Coming back to that concept of art is that they're probably, sometimes the artist doesn't even fully understand what they've made. So to arrive at that point where we all understand or something like that, or agree, I think maybe the different question would be, can we all agree what the song means, you know?
Yeah, right.
Can we agree about that? No, I don't think we'll all ever be able to agree, and I don't think we need to agree. In my own life, in my personal journey, the scriptures have made me aware of a lot of content, a lot of meaning in U2's music that I'm very thankful for. I didn't know much about, you know, the scriptural meanings when I started becoming a U2 fan. I liked the music. I knew that he was saying something that, you know, was powerful for me. But yeah, the more I've picked up on what the scriptures say and what U2 is talking about, there's so much overlap. It's enriched my experience, but I know a lot of fans who don't come to the scriptures too often, and they, you know, maybe fair play to them. They're probably bigger fans than I am of U2. They love U2 maybe even more.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart. Scott Calhoun has written and edited a couple of books on U2, including Exploring U2, Is This Rock and Roll? Essays on the Music, Work, and Influence of U2, as well as U2 and the Religious Impulse, Take Me Higher. Thanks to Anna Grummet for reading some of the lyrics out. If you know someone who would enjoy this conversation or others like it, please do let them know about Life and Faith. It helps us spread the word. Next week.
How do you bring in these legendary writers, two of whom were born the same year in 1893, Sayers and Parker, and Day was born only 4 years later, but they all came into their own in the 1920s as women writers making a living, which is so unusual. And that's why, I thought, how do you get them on stage when in real life they never met? And the only way I could figure out how to do that was through the lens of another writer.